and it was a woman's voice. And as a result of this phone call, Buckley went down to the lobby of the LaSalle Hotel and sat in a large chair. The lobby was empty. And three men ran in and shot him several times, killed him instantly, 45, and ran out again. And the only one person apparently got a good look at them inside the hotel, and that was a room clerk. There are all sorts of stories about people passing on the street who saw cars turning around and got partial license numbers. And the more the publicity, the more tips the police would get. But I worked for almost a year on that one story before anyone was brought to trial. And incidentally, no one was ever convicted of the murder of Jerry Buckley. In the paper, got an extra out early that morning. And as a result of our extra, we lost about 25,000 circulation, because we printed that Buckley had dealings with some unsavory characters, that he was reputed to have been shaking people down. And this was our best information, and the truth as we knew it, as we believed it. But so many people loved him, they didn't want to hear anything bad about him, and about 25,000 just canceled their subscription to the Times immediately. In order to overcome this, we had to eventually get the government board, I don't know what the name of it was at that time, but it would correspond to the FCC, to come to Detroit and have public hearings in which a lot of testimony was given that would reflect disparagingly on Jerry Buckley. And while we couldn't prove everything we wrote in the paper or any of the main charges, one of them I recall was he was real close to a kidnap gang. And might have been, you know, sharing in some of the profits. None of that could be proved. But the board being in Detroit did bring out some things that probably gave some of the people who idolized him second thoughts. Well, he, as I said, was murdered, and this was... We found out that he was undoubtedly the most popular man in Detroit by the public mourning, and also that nobody believed he was anything much less than a saint. His brother, Paul, had been an assistant prosecutor, and I knew him very well, and they had known him for a long time. And of course, I talked to Paul about it, and he had no idea why his brother was murdered. And but he then called me up and said, "Ray, will you do me a favor?" He said, we want to bring Jerry home before the funeral for a couple of days in the house, and we just want the family. So will you write something in the paper and ask people not to come? Just for the family. We want to be alone with them. And I said, "Well, Paul, that won't be any problem." So I wrote a box to be inserted in the main story on page one, believing that that would take care of it. Well, the house was almost torn apart by people who wanted to see Jerry or get a piece of his hair or something. They had to have the riot squad out to keep them away. At his funeral, there were crowds estimated at between 25 and 50,000 lining, you know, the roads to the cemetery. They were selling, the vendors were out selling brief biographies of his life, selling a song, Jerry, My Boy, that somebody had written. Men and women and children were weeping all along the funeral line. He was not married. He had a brother and sister, and his few relatives, and it was a pretty closely knit Irish family. Well, we started to work right away, of course, the newspapers and the police on who did it and why. We found, as you often can, many motives, real or imagined. One was that he was supposed to have taken, accepted $10,000 to effect the release of a gangster from a Canadian prison, and that it was not successful. And another was that he had been too effective in his fight to get Mayor Bull recalled, and that had hurt a lot of gangsters' pocketbooks, because the city was open in those days. There was gambling every place, blind pigs every place. But so many of them, they'd all have to be run down as best we could. And finally, the police settled on three men as being the murderers and arrested them and charged them with murder. They arrested two in Detroit and one in New York. There was Ted Pizzino, who was never much in the gang or the mob, and Angelo Lavecchi, who was never much in the gang or the mob, and Joe, Scarface Joe Bomarito, who at that time was on his way up in the crime syndicate or whatever you want to call it, but was not near the top, although he had a higher position than the other two. Now, the police theory, borne out by very sketchy statements of witnesses or people who thought they were witnesses and thought they saw something, was that they got some woman to call, who knew Jerry, to call him, get him down to the lobby. Incidentally, never found out who that woman was. And the Jerry Buckley voice, as she was called, was a very mysterious figure, and columns were written about her. But she was never identified. But at any rate, the prosecution and police theory was that they got her to calm him down, and then Angelo Lavecchi had been stationed at the Adelaide Street entrance. And when Buckley got seated in the lobby, and when the coast was clear, when there weren't any witnesses, he was to signal. And then three men pulled up in a car, two of them jumped out, and he went in with them, and they all shot Buckley. Now, that was a police theory. So those three went to trial, and it was one of the wildest, most hysterical trials I've ever covered, and it lasted an excessively long time. There are many recesses, many witnesses that fell apart. And while the police, the prosecutor, and all their facilities, while they were investigating the crime, even after the arrest of these people, there was a 23-man grand jury called for the to investigate the whole Buckley situation. And they indicted the three who are under arrest, although they also, the prosecutor had also also issued warrants. But the main witness, who had never made a statement to the police, had left town and nobody could find him. And I was, my office, the Times had me move into the hotel, live right there and cover it as part of my beat, and get to know the people who live there better and who work there better, in the hope that that would be of some assistance. Now, many gangsters lived in that hotel, many of whom I had not known before, but did come to know as part of my job while I was living there. And the police covered it, the hotel themselves, to such an extent that we often referred to it as Sub 13. It was in hotels in the 13th precinct, and the Sub 13 meant a substation. But through a contact I made while living at the hotel, I found out where this room clerk was. And he was in hiding, and he was in Chicago. So I went over there and found him, talked to him alone. And I say alone because it was that being alone gave me some worries later. I had no witness to what he told me. What he told me was that, yes, he saw the three men come in. He had a very good look at them. And he saw the shooting, and he saw them run out again. And he'd know the three men if he saw them again. But he knew, was personally acquainted with, and knew well the three men who were charged with the murder that the Detroit police were holding. And the three that were charged with the murder were not the ones who killed Jerry Buckley. Now, all the propaganda, evidence, testimony, statements that the police, the prosecutor, and the grand jury built up would just build up on these three men who were in jail waiting trial. And my story just raised a lot of hell in Detroit because it was the story of the only eyewitness. Now, the room clerk, former room clerk, told me that he was tired of, incidentally, he was working when I found him in a small hotel in Chicago. He was tired of being away and that he was going to come back to Detroit and give himself up. So he came back and the police immediately held him as a material witness and kept him in headquarters. And it was, oh, at least 2 months after he came back before he was called to the witness stand. And all during that time, I was worried that he would be brainwashed by the police while he was in their custody, and that he would take the witness stand when it was his turn and identify the three who were on trial and say that he'd never seen me in Chicago or he hadn't told me what I wrote. However, and I didn't want to go and see him while he was being held or have anyone talk to him on my behalf or ask him what he was going to do. However, when he took the witness stand, I think he was the last state's witness, and he told the same story almost word for word from the witness stand that he had told me in Chicago, that these definitely were not the people who killed him. The jury accepted that, and they acquitted the three defendants. Two of them, by the way, were tried right after that for another murder that happened at the side door of the LaSalle Hotel, the Adelaide Street entrance, short time before that. And they were convicted of that and sentenced to life in Jackson. They served some, that was Fazzino and Lavecchi. They served time and they've been released many, you know, been out of prison many years. But The shooting, the murder of Jerry Buckley was never solved, although I know the newspapers worked on it, as I say, for over a year, so did the police. And if anyone saw the thing and knew who did it, you just wouldn't come forward and say so. It wasn't healthy to be a witness in those days in a murder of that nature. It was a gangland killing. He was set up in a lobby of a hotel, which at the moment was empty, and three men went in with 45 caliber automatics, which was a standard weapon used by gangsters in those days, and they hit him many, many times in the head, and that was where they aimed always. But during that time, and I'm making strange characters, one night, several people were in my room, and a woman reporter from our paper called me over at the corner. They were mostly newspaper people, and to have a drink, kind of relax a little. And she said, "Why does that one man sit facing the door all the time?" And I said, "Well, that man faces the door all the time so he can dive under the bed if it opens, if the door opens unexpectedly." And she said, "You're kidding." I said, "I wish I were, but there's a very worried man. He's been told he's going to be killed, but I don't know what it's for." And about 2 weeks later, I called her up and said, "Look at the headline in the paper today. That was a guy who was sitting in the corner. He'd been taken for a ride. I don't know what he was, you know, why he was killed, but I know that he knew that he had it coming." Well, that's a type of person he met in the hotel. Except one morning I was coming down the elevator and stopped at a floor on the way down. The door opened and I almost fainted because two nuns in habit got on the elevator, and it was the most inconsistent, improbable sight I've ever beheld, to see two nuns in that Detroit hotel. I still think they're probably gangsters in drag wanting to get out without being recognized. The house detective, it's a wonder there weren't more being shot. One night I got off the elevator and he was ahead of me, and I cleared my throat because I was always afraid he was a little nutty and would do something. And he turned around and he had a 38 or maybe a larger caliber revolver in his hand. And I said, "What the hell's the matter?" He says, "They're making too much noise in that room and I'm going to shut them up." He didn't mean he was going to shoot him. He meant he was going to tell him to be quiet, but he was going in with the gun drawn. And I said, "Oh my God, you know, you're going to start something all over." He says, "The only way they understand it." I said, "Well, lots of luck to you." And I got in my room as soon as I could. I didn't hear any more shots, so I guess his method must have worked. There had, as I say, been... The hotel got off to kind of a bad start because not long after it opened, there was a party in the roof garden, or in the penthouse on the top floor. It would be a penthouse. And a girl who was pretty well known around town, whose name was Patsy Faye Claire, was thrown out a window, killed, and it developed as some high police official for attending the party. But I think the records to this day will show that it was an accident, that she lost her balance and fell. Although the story that we couldn't prove, but which I believe, was that she was thrown out by somebody. And well, there was a lot of names, nicknames for the place. Journey's End was the most popular, perhaps. They and people would it's strange, but the toughest people in the country, they come to Detroit, and instead of going to some place where they wouldn't be seen, would head right for the LaSalle Hotel. So there it all was. And there were a lot of traveling, and those were the days of the big gangs. There was a miniature golf course across the street. Miniature golf was popular in those days, and it used to be, there'd be people playing golf all night long, under the lights, all night, and they were all gangsters. If the police just wanted, you know, the so-called dragnet that they used to use in those days, they wouldn't have to go far, just that corner would, about a block radius that would take in most of the underworld of Detroit. I think I'll shut up for a minute. Is that any kind of a picture?
You mentioned the name Joe Bomarito in connection with the Buckley murder. He was an associate of Pete Licavoli. And Pete Licavoli was a principal actor in the Prohibition period.
Yeah, Pete is still occasionally in Detroit. His brother Yanni is has been in the Ohio State Penitentiary for, something like 35 years at least. Conspiracy to murder in Toledo, and they came up about the same time when they were friends in St. Louis, and they joined up with some others in Detroit that they knew and took over a large part of the river and bringing whiskey over from Canada, and then they expanded by selling it to wholesalers, of course, and then even to retailers, to bars. From a startup with practically nothing, they made quite a bit of money. And they didn't get into gambling for quite a while. They established gamblers in Detroit. And there was a lot of gambling then, wide open gambling. Like Danny Sullivan, Lincoln Fitzgerald, Lefty Clark, Sleepout Louie, St. Louis Dutch, the Wertheimers, Merton Hale, so many. They had very Burke Moss, very elegant places, lavish, and the top entertainment, people like Ted Lewis who were at their height then. And they had these real tough guys convinced that all the money was in bootlegging and that gambling was a hand-to-mouth existence, that they were just getting by the skin of the teeth. That was to keep them out of, you know, from muscling in on them. And it worked for years. But finally they got a little smart and started moving in the gambling business. Then many of those who had been established in Detroit moved out to Nevada, either Reno or Las Vegas. And some of them are still operating out there. But Detroit, in those days, had any just about any kind of game you wanted, one would want to gamble. Baccarat, dice, cards, stush, clavillage, anything practically, and in very convenient locations like right downtown on Woodward Avenue, or on Grand River, a block or two off Woodward, or up at Charlotte and Woodward. Bert Moss had a very fine cafe, cabaret, and gambling establishment there. And of course, E-Course downriver and up river in St. Clair Shores had lavish gambling establishments. Now, usually, one would have to be known to get in the gambling part of the dining room. But they were not too careful about that. They didn't pay much attention to the identity of the person because it was pretty obvious they must have had protection. Thing that they, in some of the downtown places, one would go into a room with nothing in it but a husky guy who worked for the gambling place, and he'd be searched, and they looked for two things. One, a gun. Two, to see that the money, that the man had enough money to get in. In other words, he'd have to have, well, in the cheaper places, at least $5 before they'd let him in. In these rooms, up above, there was a gun turret with a man with a rifle looking down to see that no one was coming in to stick the place up because they had a lot of cash. See, those places did a big business and they have a lot of cash on hand. And they didn't have guys with guns showing inside like they do in Reno or Las Vegas now, but they had protection. Then to a winner, if a person won a large amount of money, they'd do, they'd pay him, they'd give him a check if he wanted it, and the check from, you know, places run by these people I named, but check was as good as cash. But the check was so he wouldn't be held up. Or they'd send a couple of men with him to take him home safely if he wanted the cash. And if it was a large enough amount so he might be held up, they'd give him protection until he got home or give him a check either way. Of course, they were protecting their own money because, you know, a gambler always goes back. And they knew that if he won the night, when they got him home safely, he'd be back there the next night or the night after. And the averages being what they are, the house would want it back, plus some.
Ray, returning to the Buckley murder, you almost arrived on the scene at the time of the murder.
Yes, we'd worked. All the newspaper people had worked very hard for some time, particularly that day, on the recall of the Mayor Bowles. And after all the results were in and our stories were written, I remember that Tommy McIntyre and Jack Martin, who was on in the Times, McIntyre was on the news, and I walked over to Berman's, which is about a block from the Times. It was then a blind pig. And we were really too tired to drink anything and too hot. And we had a steak sandwich and a bottle of beer. Then we left Berman's and started to walk north toward, in the general direction of the LaSalle Hotel. So I said, what are we going this way for? I'm too tired. Magdar said, well, come on, walk up as far as the hotel. So Martin and I told him he was crazy that we didn't, couldn't walk at all. We were too tired, so I left them. And Martin did too, and I took a cab and went over to Leland for the night. If we had proceeded, we figured out later, we'd have arrived at the hotel when Buckley was getting in the lobby. Now, we'd have sat down because we'd have been tired after the walk and rested a few minutes at least. But we all knew Jerry Buckley, so we'd have been talking to him. Now, one of two things would have happened. Either the shooting would have been postponed because we were there, or we'd have all been killed. So this is sort of the lady and the tiger. But what finish you want to give it? Either one could have happened. McIntyre continued walking, went to the hotel. He didn't see anybody in the lobby. I don't think he did. He might have seen Buckley. But at any rate, he had gotten to his room and started to get undressed, taken off his shirt, and the telephone operator called him and said there was a shooting in the lobby. So he went down. I think he saw Buckley. And, you know, just said hello and went on up. But we all knew Jerry. So we, there again, I think if it had been anybody local, it had been postponed. If there were imports who did the shooting, if everybody had been shot because he never left anyone around. Another thing about that hotel clerk, I don't know why they didn't shoot him, the night clerk, unless they didn't see him or think about him.
Speaking of the night clerk, Ray, he seemed to do rather well financially after the trial.
Well, he, when I saw him, in Chicago, he was clerking in a very small, out-of-the-way hotel. And he was a man, to my knowledge, never had much money. After the trial, he purchased an undertaking establishment in Birmingham, in Dearborn. And as far as I know, he prospered. But until he died, a natural death. Alan Kent was one of the, getting back to the Buckley trial, one of the defense attorneys, and he had been in the prosecutor's office as an assistant prosecutor, trying mostly murder cases for many, many years. And it was sort of difficult for him to get adjusted, I always thought, to the sitting at the other side of the table. He, in a tragic end, he was talking, he had defended a man for murdering his wife. And the guy was convicted of first-degree murder and was serving life in prison, Jackson. And Alan Kent went up to the chief of detectives' office to talk to him about the case and protest the verdict, protest the way the police handled it, and was demonstrating with a handgun that it was impossible for Jenkins to have killed his wife the way the state said during the trial that he had murdered her because of the angle of the gun and the bullet. And he put the gun up to his head and, to demonstrate how it was impossible, and pulled the trigger and killed himself right in front of the chief of detectives as he's sitting there. Now, it went down as an accident. But many people close to Alan Kent thought it was suicide and that it was done that way so his insurance would give his widow double coverage. And because he had been very frustrated in his life over the way his law practice was going and several other things. And this was, of course, can't be proved. The insurance company paid it off as an accident. But the thinking was that he just deliberately, and what a setting in the chief of detective's office at his own desk. This man that he defended, his name was Lonnie Jenkins, and he sent for me. I didn't cover that trial, by the way, but he sent word to me that he'd like to see me while he was in Jackson Prison. So since I didn't know him, I took a captain of the state police with me, Hiram Marmon. Was his name, and pardon me. The prisoner said that he could, if I could get him out, he could give me the solution of the Jerry Buckley murder. Well, this has happened to me many times. An inmate of a prison will say, if you put me on the street and I'll solve this thing you're working on. So, yes, like Lazarus. He talked to the Attorney General, apparently, and some of those star investigators. You've got to take him out, and he's going to solve all our crimes.
Including non-existent.
And he's being charged currently with several counts of perjury. Well, Lonnie Jenkins said... told me that he was walking on Woodward Avenue, just turned the corner of Adelaide Street the night of the shooting. He heard the shots, saw the men run out of the Adelaide Street entrance to the LaSalle Hotel and jump into an automobile, which made a U-turn. And he took down the license number. He was carrying a free press, and he wrote it on the margin of the newspaper. Now, there was a car that made a U-turn. The men did run out of the hotel. I got in that car. Other witnesses had seen that much. But nobody had a license number, so he could have read that in the newspaper, except for the license number. So I said, Lonnie, look, I can't promise you anything except if the information you give me leads to the solution of this thing. I know that the proper persons will take that into consideration, your cooperation into consideration. So, and I'll follow it through and do everything I can for you. But tell me, what about this license number? Where is it? He said, when I went home, I tore it off. He said, I didn't stay there too long because I didn't want to get involved, but I knew it was important. And I tore the number off the paper and put it in a tin box with some other things of some value that I possessed. And when I came to prison, before I came to prison, I took them up to my sister's, took the box to my sister's house, and it's there now. And if you go there, you'll find that the number is on that little piece of paper. And that is the car they drove off in. So I said, okay, write me a note to your sister, telling her that I can see what's in the box and give me her name and address. So he did. And we went to the sister and introduced ourselves and identified ourselves with documents, and I gave her the note and she read it. And I could see she was astonished at the note. She didn't know what it was referring to. So finally I amplified what he had said in the note. I said, you know, that tin box he left here. She said, Mr. Gerard, there's no tin box in this house. He never had a tin box, and I've never seen one. And she said, she lived in a small house, in a little place. She said, would you like to look around? I said, no, you'd know if he had a tin box. So there wasn't any. He had never seen, I never heard another word, you know, about it from him. But it is typical of what many people in prison will do. They'll go to any extreme. They'll lie right up to the end, thinking that somewhere along along the line, something will fall in place for them, and they'll get out. Many convicts have told me stories in prison like that that just are not true and cannot be verified ever. But they want an opportunity, they want a chance to just to get out of prison for a while, and they think maybe they can turn something up, maybe they can, you know, find something to justify it. But there was no box, it was pure fiction. The,
Ray, do you want to talk about Alan Kent's Cicero argument?
Well, the trial of the three men who charged was Jerry Buckley. Was one of the wildest in the history of Recorder's Court. It was a jury heard it, and the judge was Jeffries, father of the man who was later mayor of Detroit. The one of the defense attorneys, the theory was that these three defendants were Italians, so of course the emphasis was on an Italian gang that murdered Jerry Buckley. Well, one of the defense attorneys, who was a good lawyer, Anthony Maiolo, was trying to counter that by having people of Polish descent responsible for murdering him. And he kept moving the scene of the conspiracy to Hamtramck and naming people in Hamtramck who actually did the murder. He named one man who's a baker out there, and I'm sure never heard of Jerry Buckley if there was anybody who did. Had nothing to do with the murder, but it was the herring that he was using. So every time the prosecution would put something on Italians, he'd come back on cross-examination and bring Hamtramck and the Poles back in the picture. And he really did a good job of with the herring. But Alan Kent, in the final argument, and he had the last word, by the way, Maiolo argued the case, putting it right back smack in the Hamtramck, naming people with Polish names who he said murdered Jerry Buckley, why they did it, some complicated theory. Kent, in his argument, and I think these words are verbatim, said, "And before the dawn of the new day broke, the real killers of Jerry Buckley were speeding in their high-powered limousine back to their rendezvous in Cicero, Illinois." Maiolo almost fainted, so did the other defense attorneys, and I know at the press table it must have been an audible gasp. It was such a shock because after all of my own hard work to change the venue of the plot and the nationality of the perpetrators, Alan Kent brought it right back to Cicero, Illinois, which of course brought only one thing to everybody's mind, and that was Al Capone and his Sicilian or Southern Italian pals.
This is September 1, 1971. Ray, you've undoubtedly had many unusual experiences with tipsters, people who have come to you ostensibly with knowledge about a crime or a story.
Yes, almost every big story, almost every big crime story, made us disprove confessions. In other words, people would come to the newspaper office or to the police and be convinced they'd be obviously people with mental problems, and they were convinced that they'd killed the person and wanted to confess it. And they usually had a pretty good knowledge of the detail, that is, they knew everything that had been printed in the paper and remembered it. And often they'd add little detail to what had been printed that you couldn't prove or disprove. And it was sometimes very difficult, but and caused quite a bit of work for us on the papers to determine whether the person was telling the truth, because if it were the truth, we naturally want the story. One of the most puzzling that ever occurred, one that I spent more time on, was the shooting of Walter Reuther and a man that came into our office wanting to help us solve who his assailant was. Now, Walter Reuther was shot in the right arm in the kitchen of his home by a shotgun. And his assailant has never been convicted. Some people were tried, but nobody's been convicted of it. So the case is still wide open. A year after, that was in April of 1948, I believe, and a year after that, his brother Victor was shot through the window of his home, and he lost an eye. His assailant has never been convicted. Now, the police had various theories, and we had various theories as to who shot Walter and Victor Reuther, and why they were shot, and of course, to this day, I don't know for sure. But the strange experience that came out of the shooting of Walter Reuther occurred several months after the shooting, and I was home on a Saturday, and I got a call from the office asking me to come down because I'd been working on the Reuther case almost exclusively. And they said they had a man who came in and seemed to know a lot about it and wanted to tell someone. So I went in the office and took him to a restaurant across the street, just so if he did have anything, it would look like a